The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon, and thank you to all of the families of our fallen veterans here on Memorial Day, and thank you to our folks who are still serving and our folks who have served.
Pretty much. Hello?
We can't hear you.
Hello?
Sorry, your lips moving, but there was no sound.
I was being a ventriloquist right there.
You know, one day we're going to check this
before we go on the air.
We just don't.
Yeah, happy Memorial Day.
Exactly. It's not a particularly... I always feel weird about that, though. But it is... it has become a three-day weekend. I don't know how long ago, but quite a while ago. And so it's somehow turned into barbecues and stuff, and I get that. But just got to remember what the day is all about. So, and there'll be lots of events tomorrow, for heaven's sakes, on Monday. Typically, Memorial Day, well, you know, six years in a row, you know, Memorial Day isn't on real Memorial Day. So there are events on the Monday, and then there are events on real Memorial Day. Tomorrow, they're all crammed on one day. People are going to be running all over the place. So we hope you can attend some stuff wherever you're local.
I think it's about boating and camping now.
Yeah, it's about wrecking the campground, actually.
Oh, that's true.
If you're here in Northern California. And littering.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So here are we, the people. You are being joined by Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
Because without one of us, we were screwed up. Together, we're kind of screwed up sometimes, too. But we're much better together than we are separate. So Bob handles all of our fun music. You have some good musical stuff for us today, Bob.
I do.
I thought you would. That's always kind of nice. So let's see. You can catch us on the West Coast here in Northern California. You can get us live from noon to 2 on Sundays at KCNR 1460 AM. You can always find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And on Saturday? Are we 2:30 to 4 in Philadelphia?
I did not get to listen yesterday.
Okay.
The previous week we were 3:30 to 5 Eastern time.
I forgot to call Rick. So we're airing back there on the Conservative Commandos Radio Network at WNJC 1360 in Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore. And it's rumored to be on Saturdays from 2:30 to 4, but it could be at a different time.
It could be Mondays and Wednesdays. We're not sure.
So, stick with the website, you know. So at wethepeopleradio.us, you can always find all of our archives back to, 2010 or something. Lots of different shows, lots of different topics. And each of our guests, we put up a pretty good page on them and give you all the links to their websites and contact information, because you may know somebody who'd like to have them on a different program. We swipe them from other people's programs, so you can swipe them from us. And you can always use our archive for whatever you like and send it to your friends and utilize it. That's what it's there for. Today we have Nina Salerno. She is, I'll just read her bio here, an accomplished former prosecutor and deputy district attorney.
Go get it.
She is the owner of the law offices of Nina Salerno, a professional corporation, as well as an executive board member for Americans' leading crime victims advocacy organization. It is called Crime Victims United, and that is our topic today. She is one of the three daughters to the Crime Victims United founders, Michael and Harriet Salerno. Nina was 11 when her older sister, Katina Rose, I'm hoping I say that correctly, was senselessly murdered, execution style, on the University of the Pacific campus. Nina and her family quickly learned that families had limited rights, and through determination to change the law and protect victims, Crime Victims United was launched. She actually became one of the nation's youngest victims advocates when, at the age of 12, she testified before President Reagan's task force on crime victims and participated in various crime victim programs. So kind of an interesting life twist. Bad reason to do it, but I guarantee you a lot of other people have benefited from their family's tragedy. So thanks for taking time out of your Memorial Day, Nina.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me. I'm very honored to be on the show.
So that's all we know about you. So everything else you will have to tell us.
Well, you kind of heard but you're right. My sister was murdered in 1979 at the University of Pacific campus in Stockton. And my family took a very overwhelming tragedy because we learned through the criminal justice system that victims had no rights. And my father and mother and myself started Crime Victims United with the thought that my sister's murder was not going to go in vain and that we would make a difference. And so we've been advocating for victims of crime ever since. I also sparked my career. I served about 20 years as a prosecutor in various counties throughout California as well. And now I work as an attorney advocating for the rights of victims.
So what was different? Okay, did they catch the person?
They did. My sister's murderer was actually her boyfriend. My sister's case is kind of gave rise to stalking laws in our state. He had stalked her. He actually stole the gun from my father. He threatened to kill her numerous times. But those things were not loud in court because the laws were different then, and that's kind of what started this whole victim thing, is that we began to feel like that the victims had no place in our system. And eventually he was convicted of second-degree murder, which carries a life sentence. But in the state of California, life does not mean life. And, in fact, we're facing our 11th parole hearing July 13th in order to try to keep him in prison.
That's what I thought. I saw a letter going out from the office the other day, and it just dawned on me last night when I was working on the webpage. I thought, wait a second, I think this is all the same thing. So how often does that come up?
Initially in the state of California, paroles were 1 to 5 years, meaning that a person could see as little as a 1-year denial or as long as a 5-year denial. In 2008, which I helped champion here in California, the Marcy's Law came into effect, and it lengthened, and that was very important to me that this be done, and was part that I was involved in. We were able to lengthen denials from a minimum of 3 to a maximum of 15 years. With the idea that families wouldn't have to endure the intensity of a parole hearing, which is probably far more worse than the actual trial in many ways. The problem is we have been usurped by the administration on that. And so although families believe that they get a 3-year denial and at least have 3 years to have some reprieve, the inmate now is allowed to apply for an advancement. So the best way I can explain is 6 years ago, we received a 7-year denial in the murder of my sister in his parole hearing, and he applied for an advancement within 1 year after receiving that denial, was denied, but then was able to apply again. So now actually the parole hearing has been advanced by a year, which is very hard on my family.
No kidding. So
do they get to do that every year? I mean, can they apply for that?
It's like child support.
It's been so changed. Normally, they're supposed to be, they should have waited at least three and a half years before he could have applied. And then they said when they denied it the first time that he can't apply again, but then the rules changed administratively again, so somehow he got to apply for another denial. And this is not an unusual circumstance. He's a very sophisticated criminal. He's done this before. I actually had to litigate it. All the way to the Court of Appeal at one time, which led to a ruling that my sister's case was actually one of the worst cases for indifference to human suffering in the state of California. It was an actual ruling out of the California Appellate Court.
Oh, my gosh.
So families, it's just really hard on victims. Parole hearings are, you're in a small room. You feel like your fate, you know, relies in the hands of people that don't know you. You know, the inmates, some of them know well how to play the game, get their education program, yet, like in the case of my sister, he's very dangerous. He has never fully admitted to everything he did in the crime. Although he looks great on paper, it's the underlying issues. Like, I was the main witness because he threatened my sister in front of me. To this day, he denies doing that. So there's all these issues, and you have to relive not only the crime, because you have to hear the facts of the crime. Then you have to be put in the position of whether or not this person that's not remorseful or not rehabilitated is getting out.
And so back in the day when this all first took place, why wasn't the information that he was stalking your sister and all that, what was I don't know what I want to ask. What was allowed in or what wasn't allowed in?
And unfortunately, in those days, a lot of the prior threats, except for the one that I actually witnessed, was not allowed in. There were some that she told my sister after she received a phone call, things like that, were not allowed in because of hearsay rules. Those rules have now changed. Oh. I think our system began to understand that, evidence needed to come in, and not taking away the rights of the defendant, but I think we were able to, and I do credit Crime Victims United with quite a bit, and a lot of our public state, like the Mike Reynolds and Mark Classes, with coming to make legislative change so that there became more of a level playing field for public safety.
No kidding. It's hard to imagine that it wasn't that long ago those things were happening. How long did it take your folks to set up Crime Victims United?
They did it within, what happened was right after my sister was murdered, it had generated quite a bit of publicity around it. My family was involved in local politics. His family was rather well known as well. So we then were, at that time, President Reagan actually commissioned a task force on victims of crime. And I ended up testifying on it at the age of 13. And that kind of just started the whole thing. And then the California Correctional Peace Officers Union, which are the union that represents the prison guards, picked up on our first parole hearing, and that's what kind of generated everything. So it was within about 5 years. That was kind of a long-winded answer.
No. Well, I was curious about that. So, bottom line is you guys went from doing whatever you were doing as a family and you being a kid to you guys spent a lot of time in court and reading law books, I'm sure, and studying all that. How many other kids in your family?
I have another sister who's actually older. I'm the youngest, and she is a nurse. And then I went into the legal field.
Okay. So. Yeah, I'm sure this completely shaped that outcome. But I tell you what, if you were the prosecutor, I bet they were sweating bullets.
Thank you. It was a great job. I enjoyed my time as a prosecutor.
I'm sure you did.
You feel like justice is served when you're a prosecutor, and it was always just a good feeling.
Oh yeah. Well, and the people on the other side could never say, "Well, you don't know how this feels." You know.
Right. And it was really nice to be able to relate with the victims and feel like, besides, oftentimes I think victims feel like they're just a piece of evidence. And I think to be able to explain to them that I've been in your shoes.
Yeah.
There was a connection, and that's why I enjoy doing what I do now. I primarily represent victims of crime.
That's fabulous. Well, we've got a million questions, and there's a ton to learn from you, so we appreciate you hanging in with us. We're going to take a really quick break. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People Radio. We are here with Nina Salerno from Crime Victims United, and I think you're going to learn a lot today. I know we're planning on it. There we go. The beginning of the break. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
Go on, take the money and run. Go on,
Welcome back. You're joining We the People Radio. We are here with Nina Salerno from the Crime Victims United. Hey, Nina.
Hi.
So when did all this happen?
My sister's murder happened in 1979.
Oh, okay. The year I graduated from high school.
Yeah. No, she graduated from San Francisco High School. She was close to start the University of the Pacific the next day.
Oh, so she wasn't even in college yet. She was just getting started.
Yeah, she had just graduated Mercy High School in San Francisco.
Wow. So we were about the same age. And how long had she been dating the psycho guy?
I kind of had the quintessential life, meaning that he was literally the boy across the street. They met their freshman year, when he moved in the neighborhood, and throughout their high school, they dated. He was the star athlete out of St. Ignatius College Preparatory School. She was top student out of Mercy. And I think that was part of the reason, besides who the families were. Like I said, my parents were involved in local politics, my dad especially. His father was an athletic director of a big high school. And it was just, crime crosses all boundaries, but I think in those days this just caught a lot of attention because it was so unexpected of the, somebody out of one of the top high schools in the city and family background and things like that.
Sure, it wasn't like they were, it wasn't like they were hanging around downtown selling drugs or something.
Right. It didn't come from a non-privileged family, to say the least, so,
Sure. And was this kid an only child, or did he have siblings?
No, he came from a family of, I think he had four or five.
So, I believe
three brothers.
Well, how does it work when you go to these parole hearings? Does his family show up and just say how nice he is? I mean, because that's what you think, but I guess if you have a family member who has committed a heinous crime, you might walk away from him.
His family is not allowed at the parole hearings. Only victims' families are allowed into the hearings.
Oh, really?
I believe his family is very supportive of him. Yes, in California, we were able to establish that. And it's because the victim has the interest. Obviously, his family can write letters, and he does get letters of support as to why he should be released. But the victims under Proposition 8, Marcy's Law, and even prior to that, victims were allowed to be heard at parole hearings. Now they're not only allowed to be heard, they're allowed to be represented by an attorney if they choose. So we were able to expand some rights for victims. And a lot of that is because the board is supposed to consider the impact of the crime on the family when making their decision.
Okay. And then how do they decide? I mean, the person's obviously convicted of a crime, so they did it. Are they just weighing? I mean, I started reading your stuff, and I realized how little I know about, parole.
It's been very scrutinized by case law. There's a lot of litigation surrounding it. It went from that they could look at the factors of the crime, and based on the heinousness of the crime, they could decide somebody is a risk to public safety. Now, through the court system, that's not the case. You have to now find what they call a nexus between the heinousness of the crime and the conduct of the inmate. And you have to find that they are an unreasonable risk to public safety, but there has to be a nexus as to the time that they served in prison, what they've done, to the actions of the crime. And it's a pretty high standard, and unfortunately it can be very subjective, and it's been heavily litigated. And so I don't even know if you know, recently they've actually just made one of the Manson murderers eligible for parole.
Because they're saying
that the person spent so many years in prison, it's now far away from the time of the crime. The basis is they have to find that the person still poses an unreasonable risk to public safety. But the court system has made it so that it's a pretty high bar that they have to, it has to be met.
How much weight is there in their rehabilitation when they're in there? I know they come in and they no doubt are on their best behavior and they're remorseful and blah blah blah. But how much weight does that really hold with the parole board?
I believe it does hold a lot of weight. They do look at the programming and things like that. Unfortunately, at least it's my, and I do believe in rehabilitation. Let me put that out there. Crime Victims United is strongly supportive of rehabilitation, as I am too, because obviously if we can rehabilitate someone, we lessen the criminal out on the streets. But I don't think we do a good job of rehabilitation. And here's what I look at. Like, I recently just argued a parole hearing for a man who murdered his wife. She happened to be a federal Department of Justice agent when he murdered her, and it was a domestic violence murder. And although he looks great on paper, he'd done a ton of rehabilitation, I was able to point out to the board to say, that's great, but none of it had to do with any domestic violence. So I hope you don't put a lot of weight into it, because one of the things they're supposed to really look at is do they have insight to the causative factors of their crime? What caused them to commit this crime? And that's really the threshold. Do they have that insight so that they don't repeat it? Well, obviously, if they're doing programming in prison, but it has nothing to do with the actual elements of the crime, then I believe that they lack insight, and that makes them an unreasonable risk to public safety.
Well, and also, I don't know how you feel about this, but some crimes I don't feel you should ever be up for parole. I don't think you ever get out for. I mean, there's folks in there that have done things that, you know, we don't ever want them out on the street. And what do you say about that?
You know, and that's really interesting that you point that up. Yeah, because there's actually litigation coming on the ballot in California. I mean, initiatives coming in the ballot in California. Two dueling initiatives. One is to eliminate the death penalty, and one is to streamline the death penalty. And I actually just testified in the legislature because I believe. And I've seen it as a prosecutor. Obviously, the death sentence is reserved for the worst of the worst. It's very rarely charged in our state. It's a very, you know, you have to commit, and normally it's multiple murders in extenuating circumstances, murder of a peace officer, you know, had the murderers in San Bernardino County not died, they would have been eligible for the death penalty. So it's those kind of cases. And my point to the legislature when I was testifying is that we need to keep the death penalty in California, because effectively, if you don't, then life without the possibility of parole becomes the ultimate, and then that gets litigated. And what I had pointed out to them, there was a case when I was at the Attorney General's office called Robert Lee Massey. He was initially sentenced to death row out of Orange County for murdering and a robbery an elderly woman. By the Roseburg Court, he was commuted to life without the possibility of parole, then commuted again to the life with the possibility of parole. He was released, and 7 months later, he murdered a father of five.
Yeah.
And my point to them is that there are some people that just don't rehabilitate. And, you know, so we need to reserve those top levels, whether it's life without the possibility of parole or the death penalty, for the most serious of crimes.
Well, and then you've also got the sex offenders, which I think there's a lot of folks that believe those people cannot be rehabilitated. I think if you look at the numbers, most of them that are released do reoffend and are locked up again. What do you do with them?
Correct. Sex offense has some of the highest rate of recidivism. I did have the privilege of serving Placer County as the head of a sexual assault unit, a child sexual assault unit. And what I learned from that, a lot of that is psychological. And so it would take extreme rehabilitative measures. And it has been proven through time and time again that those are the highest of recidivism rates. And I believe some of the most dangerous criminals, because they tend to be very sophisticated, they tend to prey on people that they have that are vulnerable because they have a relationship with them. You know, it's very rare that it does happen, but that you have a stranger sexual assault or a stranger rape. But the majority of those cases, there is some type of relationship between perpetrator and victim.
Yeah, like you just, I don't know. Like this guy, does he just, I mean, when he goes into these hearings, do they, is it like he's, I mean, all our experiences, like TV, you know, movies and stuff. Does he dress up and have his hair all cut nice and, you know, acts like he's a choir boy and, you know, it was just some, you know.
You know, it depends sometimes on the individual roommate. They don't get to dress up. They do wear their, in California, they wear their inmate uniform. They are given an attorney, that's the state of California, should they choose, or they can hire a private attorney. It depends. they're given an opportunity. The way it works is the panel goes and they go through the actual crime. And like I said, it was my father 3 years ago, so this will be the first hearing without him. But I always felt horrible for my mom and dad to have to rehear what happened to their daughter. And, you know, my sister, it always shook the three of them very, very much to have to relive that night. And, you know, for my father, he always, and I think that's true with any parent, they always felt like they failed my sister, even though there was nothing they could have done. So that was hard. Then it goes into the adjustment in prison. So that's where you go through what they've done in prison. And then it goes to a phase of parole plan. Then what happens is the district attorney, if the county sends a district attorney, has the right to ask questions through the panel to clarify. His attorney, if he has one, has the right to ask questions. Then it goes back to the panel, then back to the district attorney. Then the inmate gets to make a statement, and then the inmate's attorney, and then the family gets to talk, the family of the victim. And that was something Crime Victims United changed. Prior, in our first parole hearing, the inmate actually got to speak after us, and it was pretty offensive because he pretty much tore apart my family. So we urged, and I have to say, California Department of Corrections did work with us, and we were able to make an administrative change where the victims of the family got to speak last, so they didn't have to endure being ridiculed by the inmate.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's kind of an overall scenario, and it's a very small room, about the size of the living room at best in most of these prisons, so it's a pretty intense situation. Quite honestly, my dad was elderly. My parents are elderly, so last year I had their private doctor even come last time because I was actually worried about one of them having a heart attack. Obviously, a great fear of him harming myself or my sister if he gets out. You know, our family's justified in fighting to keep him in, but we've been very vocal. Obviously, there's been a lot of laws changed because of my family, and I think he has a lot of a vendetta against him, and so that's always been my parents' fear.
Well, I you know, it's funny. That was one of my questions. I kind of forgot earlier, but I figure if somebody like that gets out, I mean, yeah, you go right back after the family.
You know, they do a lot of different things. I mean, he's been in there. He's been in there over 30 years. He's been in since he was 19. So I obviously, he's not going to have a tough time adjusting back into society. And there is a real fear. Like I said, I was one of the main witnesses because he threatened my sister a week prior to murdering her, and I was standing right there. You know, I was a kid, so I didn't say anything. I knew him. He apologized. So I've lived with that all my life, that perhaps if I had said something, maybe the outcome would have been different. But
yikes.
I can't change the past. But he adamantly denies it. And actually, he always basically, he doesn't quite say I'm a liar, but comes as close as he can. So that's always weighed with me, is that he has that much hatred towards me because he believes I'm lying in his mind. So there's those kind of factors that weigh in through my whole family. And I have a young daughter, and although she didn't know her aunt, she knows of the circumstances, and I see the fear in her when I have to go argue the hearing. So it permeates all generations of the family.
No kidding. And just keeps coming back up over and over and over again.
Correct.
Wow.
You know, you were talking earlier about what can and can't be used in some of these hearings and how some of the laws have changed since your tragedy. I just want to be clear that as those laws change, do you now get to use that information in those hearings?
No, because in the hearing, they have to, what is litigated in trial, if the person goes to trial, if they don't go to trial, it's within the probation report when they plea, are accepted as the true facts of the case. So no, you can. You know, I feel good that my family was able to make changes and bring about more of a balance in the scales for law enforcement, for public safety. It didn't benefit my family, and that's fine. We've been able to benefit going forward other people.
Okay.
But no, they have to only use, and our case did go to trial, and I've read all, you know, I think almost 4,500 pages of the trial transcript. So it did go to trial, and that is what is accepted as true by the board.
It seems not real fair if certain things could not be admitted at that time the laws change, and had it been allowed at the time, that the sentence would have been stiffer or different than what you're dealing with now.
Right, and I truly believe had things come in, it probably would have been very different. But then again, too, we have a balance in our system, and to allow things that were not allowed at trial would be unfair to the accused or the inmate.
I don't know, though. You know, you look at the people who've lost someone like your family. You know, here's a member of your family that was taken, you know, long before they ever really got to live their life. And you guys have to deal with this over and over and over again.
It's been tough. It's been it's a very tough road to go, but you have no other choice.
Exactly. When does this does this hearing come up?
This hearing is July 13th this year.
So it's right around the corner.
Yeah, so it's taking a toll on our entire family. I'm newly married, and my husband, who had never been, or I'm actually engaged, about to be married. It's even him, who just came into the family. It's a toll on him as well.
Yeah, it's like welcome to our little family project here.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I guess we should, Bob, do we have to take a quick break? Sorry, kind of tardy on our breaks here. We'll be right back. We're chatting with Nina Salerno from Crime Victims United. Plenty more to come here at We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
So who keeps calling?
You're not going to get any defense out of Nina. She's going to chase you down and put you in jail. Good for her. So, Nina, talk to us about Crime Victims United. The note here on your site says it's the only organization of its kind using education, legislative advocacy, and political action to enhance public safety, promote crime reduction measures, and strengthen the rights of crime victims. I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot to take on. Uh-oh. Nina's been abducted.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear you. I dropped my phone, to be quite honest.
That wasn't you being abducted. I was like, so they sucked her out of her shoes. The aliens got her. Okay, your organization takes on a huge swath of work on behalf of victims. And it's currently in California, but you're spreading across the country? Is that correct?
We are currently, we originated in California. We are currently looking to expand across the nation. We are the only group like us in the nation that does advocate on a political and legislative level for victims. I'm working with, I believe you probably know who Sheriff David Clark Jr. is out of Milwaukee.
Oh, yeah, Wisconsin. He's great.
We're very good friends. In fact, he was our keynote speaker 2 years ago at the Victims' Rights Memorial that we hold in Sacramento every year in celebration of National Victims' Rights Week. And we've become very close friends, and so we're looking to put a chapter there in Wisconsin to help with their victims' issues. I have helped in the state of Louisiana. In fact, Louisiana, this is quite interesting, up until last fall, if a victim was raped and then went through a rape kit, actually got a bill to pay for their own rape kit. So that was something that we assisted in helping to change.
Wow.
And so we're working in that state. And I also have been contacted from some correctional officers I work with in Florida about looking at doing it. So it's my goal to help bring it nationwide. One of the other things that we did is when we did California's Marcy's Law, which amended the Constitution for victims' rights, and that was landmark. There was nothing like that in the nation. It has now proceeded to other states kind of as a national model. So we're working in various ways to work across the United States.
Well, that part is fantastic. So talk to me about what's going on with crime, with victims' laws around the country. Are they just, you know, still really behind?
It's definitely different in every state. At least every state now has some type of recognition of victims' rights. To the degree varies. California is actually one of the broadest, and I believe that's because we were one of the first, which is why it served as a model. But different states each have some rights. Now, the issue also comes down to enforcement. Even though we have these great rights in California, there's really no remedy if they're breached. And that's something that I've encouraged other states to look at. What do we put in place if there's a breach of, you know, and here's the best example I can give you. If you all remember when Governor Schwarzenegger commuted the sentence in his last hour of Bobby and Nunez's son.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you know the story. Okay.
And no, I don't know the details, but I remember it.
Okay. Fabian Nunes was Speaker of the House. His son, Esteban Nunes, murdered a young, very promising college student named Luis Scott Santos. And in his very last act as the governor of the state of California, I believe it was at 11:58 at night, with a stroke of the pen, he took what was a 17-year sentence and cut it down to less than 6. The family of the victims had never been notified, and we actually had in place that before a change of sentence takes place, a victim should be heard. So I, along with a partner attorney named Laura Strasser, actually represent the family of the victims and levied a lawsuit against the state of California, and we're actually still in litigation over it. Unfortunately, he's now been released. My hope was we were going to try to resolve it and the original sentence would have been put back in place. That didn't happen because he's been released because our court system takes so long. But now we're at least litigating to say that the arguments come down to it didn't apply to a commutation. And we're litigating that it does apply to a commutation. And we were actually able to amend the statute so it does apply to a commutation. But we're still litigating it just because I want the system to apologize to the family, basically.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
So we've gone from the appellate court and waiting to hear from the California Supreme Court if we're going to be accepted to be heard.
Yeah, because that's, I mean, let's face it, that's not fair. That's just a, you know, who you know justice system at that point.
Oh, it was such background politics because this kid Esteban was a cold, calculating murderer. There were two defendants, and what Schwarzenegger has tried to say to the public is, well, we don't know. He wasn't the actual murderer. There were two knives, and Luis was stabbed through the heart. Well, that's not true, because there was evidence pointing to both of them. Typical of co-defendants, they were pointing to each other, and it was actually going to trial. So, effectively, Governor Schwarzenegger has misled the public when he did that.
God. Wow. And so what happens? Do you deal with any of the stuff at the federal level? Because I know Obama's letting all sorts of people out and changing
sentences. What
I've done
recently at the federal level, it's actually kind of interesting. I've not done straight victims work at the federal level, but there is a movement across the nation that I don't know if you're aware of to eliminate bail. And right now I'm working with the bail agents In that litigation, there's been several there's a federal lawsuit filed in San Francisco, one in Sacramento, and a few other states. And some people think it's kind of odd that a victim would work with bail agents, but my point being is that I believe, and I've always been a supporter of bail, because bail ensures justice. Lots of times when we let these people out on what we call a promise to appear or own recognizance, the wheels of justice get halted. And they don't show up, and then court sentences and the victim's day in court get delayed. I mean, I believe in Sacramento County alone, there's something like 90,000 warrants. Most of them are these, I think all but 2% are due to people that did not show up for their sentences when they were released pending trial. And I just, for me, for the victims, it's important that whatever the outcome is, it's important to still have your day in court, and to have it halted because somebody was released with a promise to appear just seems offensive. Also in California, the Constitution says that the victim's safety has to be considered before somebody is released. And if they eliminate bail, that eliminates that component that I think is very important when you look at domestic violence, sexual assault cases.
Wow. Well, I think that anybody who's been a victim of violent crime would be happy that you guys are working on this, because it's a, you know, you have really two split camps. California, I don't know if it's just weirder than
California,
other states, but
you know, since the AB 109, we've got so many criminals on the streets now. And then they just release them.
Well, and then what, Prop 47, where they made a bunch of felonies, misdemeanors, and
Which made them less dangerous?
I don't know about where you live, but where we are, it's just, yeah.
There's definitely a spike in crime in California and actually across the nation. I believe California is meeting that spike in crime by statistics. And I think there's various things to attribute it to, and I think I'm a proponent of rehabilitation. I think it's important. I think it's extremely important, especially with juveniles and things. But I think what happened is some initiatives, some changes came in without a whole lot of thought. And you bring up like the lessening of some of the sentences. Well, what some people didn't realize in the state of California is what is called considered serious and violent is a very narrow category of crimes. It does not even include domestic violence. It doesn't include some child sexual assault if the child's over 14. It doesn't include assaulting a peace officer. I mean, some pretty heavy crimes are now, they were not considered violent or serious. So then their sentences got reduced. And
wow.
I think the intention and the philosophy behind some of these things are good. But I think the research and what is really important as to how we apply them is what's been detrimental.
I think it goes in waves. We had, I don't remember who it was, we had somebody on the program who was a nationwide crime analyst guy. And so he looked at trends over periods of years, and he said, you know, it happens all the time. You watch the laws get. You know, easier just because crime is down because we've had really stiff laws. So then you relax the laws, crime goes up. I mean, and then the crime gets out of hand, and you know, here we go again. So I think we're crawling our way back up to stiffer laws. We need to take one more quick break before the top of the hour. Sorry about that. Then we'll be back with Nina. And we're talking about Crime Victims United. We're talking about crime victims, actually. But the name of her website is crimevictimsunited.com. We will be right back. Okay. You're listening to We the People here at wethepeopleradio.us.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. And time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
I shot the sheriff,
but I did not shoot the deputy.
I shot the sheriff,
but I didn't shoot the deputy.
Yeah, no shortage of crime songs. So, Nina, we have you as our hostage for the second hour here, but before we close out this hour, Bill and I were talking in the break. What about those people who get arrested for a violent crime, then go to prison and commit another one? Like, he knew a kid. What was he, 16, 17?
Oh, he was a senior in high school, and they had a drug deal that went bad, and him and another kid pretty viciously murdered another schoolmate. They got caught. He went to prison for murder. Within a year or two of being locked up, he killed somebody in prison, and now he is in Pelican Bay. Now, how does a guy like that ever come up for parole?
You know, it, again, depends on how they're charged and what they're sentenced to. So it's going to depend. I can't speak to that case, but yes, they do, because it all depends on the sentence that they receive.
Oh, my gosh, because you would think that would be like, this one's a bad one, like bad seed, no parole.
You would think that, but it just, again, always depends on circumstances, the charging, and what the ultimate outcome is.
Hmm.
Wow.
So I guess there's always hope.
Yeah.
Yes, that's kind of how our system was designed, I guess.
Yeah.
No kidding. Do you find a big split between, like, grown-ups that commit crimes? And I don't mean, like, they're just over 18, but I mean someone who's, you know, maybe gets caught, who probably was a career criminal and gets busted in their, you know, 40s, say, versus somebody who commits a crime, you know, at 18?
Well, I mean, the code allows for several factors to be looked at. They're called aggravating and mitigating factors. Sometimes age comes into play, circumstances, home life, motive is big, things like that. So there is a lot of discretion, and I do, and all the district attorneys I work with in California, they do use discretion. Like, and as I can point out, the death penalty is rarely charged all across the state.
Oh, yeah. And we've got questions about that, because we don't know anything about that.
So it's all discretionary.
Ugh. Which I guess is good and bad, depending on who's doing it. Nina Salerno with Crime Victims United. We are coming back with her in the second hour. You've got 5 minutes to grab some coffee, or I don't know. It's a sunny afternoon. You might not want coffee at this point, but do whatever you like, and we'll come back with her in just 5 short minutes. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. We are here on Memorial Day, actually. We hope that you're enjoying time with family and that you're remembering our fallen, because it's not just the second Veterans Day. This is the one where we remember folks who have given their lives for our country.
Yeah. Take some time and visit a memorial.
Exactly. There are lots of events going on, especially Monday. So we're here with Nina Salerno with Crime Victims United, and I really didn't realize, Nina, how far behind, actually, some of the victims' laws were around the country. I guess by the time I started paying attention to that stuff, it seemed like victims had a lot of rights.
Yeah, it's definitely been a growing process, to say the least.
And is it typically championed by people who have been impacted, like your family?
Yes. You know, and everybody knows Mark Foss. I work a lot with Mark. It's been those motivating factors. And that's kind of the only sad thing that I think is it seems to always take a tragedy to spark differences. And I think you said it better earlier. You had an analyst on to say, you know, sometimes we forget. When crime is not on the rise, it becomes a secondary issue. It's not in the forefront. And unfortunately, it's probably going to take another tragedy to bring back change to have safer communities.
Well, because that's where California's headed. I mean, obviously, with AB 109, the prison overcrowding thing, so we let a whole bunch of people out, and then Prop 47, we turned a bunch of felonies into misdemeanors, and basically let a whole bunch of other people out. You know, we're seeing, even in our small towns, oh, and then the legalization of, you know, drugs. I was up in Siskiyou County, last Thursday, I guess. It's a county with, I don't know, several thousand people. I mean, it just doesn't have that many people in the whole county. And they have Asian gangs carrying, like, machine guns in their neighborhood, threatening the people who live there on, like, five-acre parcels in a rural subdivision. And bottom line is, by the time the police get there, they're gone. And
right.
And they're still patrolling the neighborhood after the police leave, so nobody can say anything. And these are the folks that are the big dope growers. And California's looking at legalizing marijuana. I mean, how crazy is that?
It is crazy. I mean, I think everything looks like, if go back to even within our system, is a balance. You know, there was a legalization for medical needs, and according to the medical community, there were medical needs for that. If it is going to be legalized in California, but then we have to look at putting in things such as, you know, how do you tell somebody's under the influence when they're driving? Because it's not a test like a DUI. So there's going to need to be, if we're looking at it, and those and like you bring in the gangs, how are we going to deal with all of that? You know, we're so close to Mexico. How are we going to deal with the cartels? And I think before things, if they do move towards legalization, that also needs to be looked at. Then how are we going to protect our citizens?
Oh, yeah, because up there, this is not a major metropolitan area, and yet if you go into their shopping center, because they really only have one big shopping center in Yreka, they see all these license plates from Wisconsin and Minnesota and all these places out of town, and they've come there to grow pot.
Right. I mean, it's an industry, let's say that. And like I said, I think however the trend goes, I mean, obviously sometimes you can't stop trends. There's different philosophies. But I think it has to look at then how, if it's going to be implemented, what do we put in place to make sure the public safety is still upheld? So we don't have people driving under the influence and killing other people. So we don't have cartels coming in. What are we going to do? Those are those questions. And I go back to even like with some of the initiatives and propositions about rehabilitation or prison overcrowding. I don't think there was a lot of thought then, okay, if we're going to implement these, let's do it strategically. Let's do it right. Let's still keep public safety in the forefront.
Yeah, because, I mean, as a prosecutor, I'm sure you were gritting your teeth through that whole thing.
It was frustrating because I don't, and especially because I don't think victims were being heard. And again, because I don't think people understood that violent crimes is a very narrow category in California. That somehow just got missed in the whole play. And like I said, some of those things that received lesser sentences, I'm not saying all, but some should not have been. I mean, I think domestic violence, and perhaps it's because of my personal story with my sister, because of having been a domestic violence prosecutor, is probably one of the most misunderstood crimes and the most not effectively remedied crimes, meaning rehabilitated for the person. And to see it not be considered a violent crime in our system, I always found that kind of amazing. Because obviously those are the most vulnerable of victims. There's a relationship there and an intimate relationship.
We don't consider... Wait, say that again? Domestic violence is not considered
a serious or violent crime in California.
Holy crap.
That was one of the things that was kind of missed when some of these initiatives came in. There was that, some child sexual assault was not considered. If a child's over 14, it's not considered violent or serious in California. Well, I have teenagers, and to me, they're actually almost more vulnerable than the younger ones because we tend to watch our younger ones more closely.
Yeah, they have a wider range.
Right. You know, and as you try to raise your kids, you try to teach them independence and freedom, but so our system says it's not violent or serious if they're over 14. And I just always thought that was just not correct because there's so much vulnerability there that can be preyed on.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I had no idea. Well, you would...
You know, and especially... Go ahead.
Well, you would think if it was a... I mean, I don't know. How do you say if it's a domestic violence thing that that's not violent?
It's not considered a serious or violent felony in California, and that was something that some of these initiatives actually have made for lighter sentence of. And again, like I said, those are, I think, some of our more prevalent crimes and some of our most dangerous crimes because of that relationship.
Well, it's kind of
weird.
And
then you add in, like we were just talking about with sexual assault and teenagers, you add in the whole cyber world on top of it now.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's kind of odd because police know that domestic violence things are super dangerous. And that's where all sorts of bad things happen.
Oh, yeah, when the woman goes, or the man, depending. I mean, there's male victims, too. Go to leave is usually the most dangerous time. And, again, it's something that's just missed, was missed when all this was thought about. And I'm not saying anybody's intentions, like I said, and the philosophies were wrong. I just think it wasn't vetted well.
Yeah. And what about death penalty? Since you've looked at crime across the country and from a victim's standpoint, Does death penalty, places that have it and use it, they have fewer,
you know? I can share with you a pretty personal story on that where I see what the benefit, and I share this with the legislature. I am, in my role at the state of California with the Attorney General's office, I had the privilege of starting the first Office of Victim Services for the statewide office of California. And I authored what was called the Death Penalty Notification Program where prior to that, we did a horrible job of involving victims in the process, keeping them informed. So we started this process, and in my tenure there, there were four executions where we involved the victims' families. They were able to all speak at the clemency. And two things I would say to that. There are some victims that don't believe in the death penalty and didn't want it, but I only came across one victim in my entire time there that just had a strong moral belief against the death penalty. The other victims wanted to see it proceed. And so it's kind of a long story, and bear with me, but this will apply to your county. And I believe, what county are you guys out of?
We're in Shasta County.
Okay, it's a Shasta County case. In 1979, a man named Darrell Keith Rich reigned terror on your county for 2 weeks. And by the time he was done, 11 women had been assaulted and or murdered, including a 12-year-old girl that he threw off a 101-foot bridge after he had sodomized her, broke every bone in her body, and she bled to death for 24 hours. And there were about four surviving women. My facts might be a little bit off because it's been a while, but one of the surviving assault victims and I were walking out of the execution chamber when it was all over that night. And I'll never forget this. She turned to me and said, thank you. And I said, no, I should be thanking you for the courage to have spoken out. And she said, no, thank you. She said, for the first time since this happened 16 years ago, I'm going to sleep in peace tonight. I'm not going to worry about getting a phone call that his sentence was overturned. I'm not going to worry about getting a phone call that he escaped. I'm not going to worry that he's outside these prison walls and going to come back and finish killing me because I testified against him. To me, that was the true value of the death penalty. That's when I learned it. For these victims, it was the ultimate peace. And to hear this young woman say that, just really, and to this day, I almost tear up when I think about it. It just gave the true value as to why the death penalty is reserved for the worst of the worst, and why, from the victim perspective, it is such a necessary sense of justice.
Wow. Well, oh, Bob's giving us the high sign so we don't get behind again. All right.
I'm sorry. I'm probably talking too much.
Well, no,
passion, and I apologize.
No, that's why you're here. That's our problem is we get all caught up in the story, and then it's like, oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. We can't just go endlessly. We'll just take a really quick break. We'll be right back.
Okay. All right. Bye.
We're chatting with Nina and Salerno from Crime Victims United. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a damn's busted. better get on back to town. Face the sad old truth, the dirty law down. Put those ideas in your head.
Welcome back. All right, so Nina, we have a chat window going here on Sunday afternoons during the program, and so we've got some questions. How long did the Daryl, what's his face? How long did he stay on death row before they actually executed him?
It was, and again, it's testing my memory.
Ballpark.
But I want to say it's either 16 or 17 years.
Okay, and so. What about all these, you know, I mean, it seems like people get the death sentence and then nothing happens. They don't actually die. They just hang out on death row. Is it?
Until they die.
Yeah, until they die. I mean, it's kind of like the same death sentence they would have gotten, you know.
It's room and board for the rest of their life.
From being alive. Does that change their parole thing and the ability, I guess, for them to come up for parole? And does it matter? I mean, if we have a death sentence and we don't use it, is it still worth having?
Well, the death sentence does not make them eligible for parole. They're obviously fought in the appeal process. And like I said, there are two competing initiatives this year. One is to make it still a fair process, but a more streamlined process so that it would actually probably, not speed up, but would speed up the system, I guess is the best word. Not sponsored by the California District Attorneys Association. And again, I do believe it's worth still having, even though the wheels of justice are slow, because if you take off the ultimate punishment that is reserved for the worst of the worst, then I think the system's going to be harmed, because then the ultimate punishment is life without the possibility of parole. Well, what happens as a prosecutor, if you do charge death, there becomes some negotiations. As we all know in our system, a lot of cases go by way of plea bargain. So somebody may actually flee and spare a family from going to trial to life without possibility of parole to not receive the death sentence. So if you remove that death sentence, then the plea becomes life with the possibility of parole. And that then puts families and victims in having to endure parole hearings. So I do think it's important to have. Again, I am a supporter of the death penalty. I believe that our district attorneys do an excellent job of applying discretion when they charge it. Like I said, it's reserved for the worst, usually multiple murderers or the murder of a peace officer. There's a whole host of special circumstances. And I think what we also forget is that our system is the greatest system. You know, I may not always agree with the jury verdicts I got, but I believe in our system because we have a jury system. So 12 individuals, the peers of that individual, decided that the case was heinous enough not only to convict the person of first-degree murder, which is a premeditated murder, but then to go through a penalty phase and decided that what act this individual did rose to such an atrocious level of disregard for human life that they deserve a death sentence. And I think we usurp our jury system when we do not honor that. I mean, our whole system was based on that. We're the only country in the world that where you are presumed innocent until you're found guilty. And yet we choose to usurp that. And I think that's a disservice to the basic principles of our nation.
Well, I guess I'd agree. And the other thing I'm curious about, since you kind of look at it on a nationwide level now, do places that have the death penalty and use it, I'm assuming Texas is probably way up there. Do they have, I don't know, fewer violent crimes, you know, per capita? Is there any?
You know, that actually came up in this hearing I was at, and nobody knew the answer. So nobody knows that.
Really?
And if it is, you know, a deterrent, that's always something that's been said. But like I said, my position, and it would be an interesting fact to find out, but I think my position is more of the basis of justice for the victims. Like
sure.
I said, for these victims, it is the ultimate justice, and it's what a jury decided they deserve. And so that's where I come from on it. But like I said, nobody's really ever done the stats on it.
Wow, because you would think that if there's a, you know, huge deterrent, that would be I don't know, but they're criminals and they're not usually all that smart. So I don't know. Maybe they don't calculate those things.
And maybe they don't. I'm not sure. I mean, I would have to think when the three strikes law was in, it served as a deterrent. I mean, obviously, our crime went down during those years. So if you could base it off something like that, I suppose. But again, I think it's just the whole system of justice, and I think it does a disservice. And it's been 9 times, which I find it interesting that it's being litigated again, that it's come to the people of the state of California, and the people of the state of California have said, we want the death penalty reserved for the worst of the worst.
Speaking of the three strikes law, how do you think that's working?
Did we get rid of it?
No.
They modified it. I was against it. And my reason being is it now takes another victim to have your third strike implemented. When the law was originated, it was if you had 2 prior strikes, your third felony could be anything. And as far as I know, there is only 1 person that ever went to prison for a check writing as a third strike, but he had 2 prior murders.
They always throw up the case of some guy that stole some pizza or something, got his third strike, and that's why it's not fair. But
that case is interesting because if you look at the facts, and I was privy to some of it, again, we're testing my memory, it wasn't that he just simply stole a pizza. These were kids. He was intimidating. There was a whole host of factors involved, mm-hmm. which is why the prosecution charged it. And I worked in the 3 strikes unit when it came in Sacramento County, and there was a lot of discretion used. It was not charged automatically on every case. There was a lot of scrutiny in people's backgrounds. Were they repeat murderers? Were they repeat rapists? Do we need them off the streets so the people are safe? You know, it was not a willy-nilly charging. And I put a lot of faith in our system. I put a lot of faith in our district attorneys. They're elected officials by their constituents. Obviously, if the constituents don't agree with them, they can unelect them. And there's a lot of discretion applied.
Do you think it helped criminals, so to speak, with prosecutors that didn't really want to give them their third strike?
Yes, and even if they did charge them with the third strike, a jury had to convict them. A jury had to find the prior strikes true. And a judge actually has the ultimate discretion to strike them. Mm-hmm. So there was protections in place. I did not personally see the abuse of it. A lot of the cases that have been brought up, I don't see them as abusive because people are forgetting the background of the person.
Right.
And that's just 2 convictions. The other thing that has to be looked at is sometimes people are convicted of a charge that's not reflective of what they actually did because it was a plea negotiation. So, for an example, somebody could be charged with rape, yet plead to a lesser offense of rape. They were pled to false imprisonment. Because that was a way of negotiating the case, getting a good sentence, but yet sparing the victim from testifying. Well, false imprisonment doesn't show the same as a prior rape. So you also have to look at the circumstances behind the pleas and the charges.
Right. And we often don't hear those details. We only hear the outcome.
Correct. Yeah. And that's, you know, useful for people that want to have lesser sentences, is that those details don't come forward.
And why you would want to do that, I don't know, because, I mean, I guess they don't think that any of these things could happen to their family.
I think that has a lot to do with it. I think a lot of people don't understand or haven't taken time to understand the net effect of crime, and not just on the families, but you think about it, on society in general. I know people always say, well, stealing from Walmart and things like that is a victimless crime. True, a person was not harmed, but yet the net effect is it's always passed on to the consumer. If it goes high enough, they have to cover their costs, you know, their insurance costs for liability and theft and things like that. That's why one of the biggest arguments was that first-degree burglary should not be a prior or serious, should not count as a serious or violent felony. Well, what people didn't realize is usually somebody going in a house to burglarize is going in with not just an intent to take property, but usually harm an individual. That's how a lot of rapes happen, things like that. So there was a reason why that stayed as a serious crime in our system.
And is that changed now?
No, it is still actually a serious crime. Carjacking, I believe, was removed from the list, which I thought was interesting, too, because a lot of people die as a result of carjacking.
Carjacking is not a serious crime?
No, it's not a serious crime anymore.
All righty then. Who's making these? Who comes up with that?
Again, it's like I said, it was like this big waft that came through, and I don't just think there was a lot of vetting to it, unfortunately. And so now it's taking its toll on society, I think. But I think hopefully we can get it turned around.
Oh my gosh, yes, that's just totally stupid.
You know, my goal would be to work even with the people that supported these initiatives, to meet with them, to talk to them and say, where can we agree? To maybe look at some statistics, see what we can change before we have another poly class. You know, I'm very close to Mark, and I've seen his heart break, just like I watched my own parents' heart break, and I would love to prevent that from ever happening to a family.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Well, all those kinds of things, how can any of that be considered? Yeah, because what is it, non-serious, non-violent, non-something, and they had the, what is it, the three nons?
Right, it's non-serious, non-violent, and I forget what the third one is.
I do too. I always miss the third one. But some of the things that fall under that category are, I mean, you'd have a hard time convincing a normal person that actually applied. All right, we need to take one more quick break here, and we will be right back with Nina Salerno. We want to find out what's going on with Crime Victims United and how people can help you when we come back.
Okay, great. Hey, come on.
Join us online. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Rough, rough.
Nina's got a dog.
Yes, she does.
Indiana wants me. Lord, I can't go back there. Indiana wants me. Lord, I can't go back there. I wish I had you to talk to. If a man ever needed dying, he did. No one had the right to say what he said about you. And it's so cold and lonely here without you. Out there the laws are coming. I'm scared so tired of running. Indiana wants me. Lord, I can't go back there. Indiana wants me. Lord, I can't go back there. I wish I had you to talk to. Hey, don't wanna go with that gun in your hand. I said, hey, don't wanna go with that gun in your hand. I'm going out and find my woman now. She's been running around with some other man. I said, I'm going out to find my woman. She's been running around with some other man.
Yikes.
Definitely needs to be an application of the stalker law there. Where do you find this stuff?
That was some classic Los Angeles garage rock from the 60s.
You even have garage rock in there, huh? Wow.
If you were in Southern California in the 60s, you know it.
I did not know there was such a thing. Oh, that's funny.
Southern California in the 60s?
Well, I knew there was such that thing, but
okay.
I didn't. Yeah, you didn't know about garage rock either.
Garage rock, get out of here.
Did you know?
Oh, sure.
I need to get out more.
Yeah.
I was living in Connecticut. What the hell do I
know?
Have
you ever heard of the Archies?
Apparently not. Hey, my gosh.
Yeah, so we, over your head.
Yeah, forget it. So we're here.
No, that was The Leaves, by the way, later redone by Jimi Hendrix.
So they had a garage band called The Leaves?
The Leaves.
Yeah. That was the first thing they had to do before they played every
day. Blow out the leaves.
Blow the leaves out of the garage.
Mom's like, those leaves are making too much noise in the garage, honey. That's funny. So Nina, with Crime Victims United, as you guys are kind of spreading this across the country and all that, how can people actually help you?
You know, people can help us by, obviously, you have our website. They're free to contact us. We do a couple annual fundraisers if they want to be supportive. If they can't, just being active in supporting legislation and going to their elected leaders saying we want this, writing letters. We try to put out an update every week of what's going on across the state. Hopefully we're doing that across the nation soon. And just really being involved. And like I said, we do two annual events. One of the branches of Crime Victims United is a charitable branch, and it was generated from my passion because I was young when my sister was murdered. I don't think we do a real good service to young victims of crime, of helping them. We provide therapy in our state, but we don't, you know, it's always, which is good, that when somebody's in prison or juvenile hall, they're given education, they're given all these things to help make them better people, but we don't provide that for victims. So one of the things we try to do at the charity is we try to find young victims who have survived some pretty hard things and are going on to higher education to make a difference in the world, and we try to help fund their college years. So we always do something to support that, and then we always have an annual dinner. Like I said, David Clark Jr. spoke at it, where we raise funds to keep the political branch going. But a lot of that, outside of that, is people just being informed, you know, and we try to help educate the voters and being out there to help us educate them, to be supportive of victims. And it's not just victims of crime, but it's public safety and law enforcement as well. Law enforcement is taking a very hard toll right now. I find it really almost, you know, I just find it sad that the people that put their lives on the line are actually being so disrespected publicly. I mean, these, I've been around law enforcement all my life. You know, as a prosecutor, I worked hand in hand with officers. And they go above and beyond, and yet they're being so disrespected. And that's not to say that in any profession there are some bad apples.
Sure.
But, you know, to disrespect their position of trying to keep us safe. And I was just talking with my fiance the other night that these people that are disrespecting them have the right to disrespect them because of what we do, because we protect their rights. And I just think that's just kind of just an oxymoron, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, that's been really popular lately. I mean, along with all this whole, you know, kind of Occupy thing and all that, is it is almost back to the 60s. Maybe the thing with the leaves, maybe I'll get current with all that on the second round. It seems like we're back there again.
It does. I mean, and it's, again, you know, people have rights in this country that, which are so, people have died for. I mean, here we're talking about it on Memorial Day weekend. But, you know, my brother-in-law spent 27 years in the military and tore us through Iraq just to preserve our rights. And some people take it such for granted. And it's okay to speak out. It's just the disrespect issue, I think, that's really kind of sad.
Sure. And without those folks, it's funny. It's almost like the whole atheism thing. You know, they're all big, solid atheists until something bad happens, and it's like, oh, God, you know.
Exactly. You know, and it's, you know, law enforcement, military, they don't discriminate who they help. They're still going to help you, but it just gets so forgotten. It's just sad. Like I said, and like today's fitting, being that it's Memorial Day weekend, you know, I always make our teenagers go and pay service and go to, you know, one of the events to realize that it's not just about barbecues and getting your family together and things like that,
yeah,
which is all great. But we're able to do that because of the people that die for us.
Exactly. Well, you know, and the other group of people that are much maligned, and sometimes for good reason, are our elected officials. But I know that you had the congressional office, you had Congressman LaMalfa's office write a letter to the parole board about your sister's case. Do you do that every single time he comes up?
I know your congressman very well. He's a personal friend. I admire him very much. I know it's a tough race up there. He's just, to me, what I know and worked with, he's always been there for his constituents to make sure public safety is in place. So he has always voluntarily written one. Whatever office he served in. And we do that. We encourage victims to reach out when they are facing their own parole hearings, to not only have family and friends, but to have local leaders help support them in their quest to keep somebody that's not rehabilitated or remorseful in prison.
Does that help?
It does.
I mean,
it
you
does
figure
help
it can't hurt, you know.
Right. The parole board does have to listen to public outcry. And, you know, because that person is going back to their county, to their,
yeah,
you know.
Going back to their community.
Right. And again, like I said, I can't stress enough that we believe in rehabilitation, and I've seen it work. And there are times when Crime Victims United have also assisted in those that have truly shown remorse and rehabilitation and worked with them in things to help reestablish. We had one of our scholarship programs is we always try to find a young kid that may have been going down a different path, and rehabilitated and now is going out to do something good for the community, and we do give money towards that. So, it, you know, I don't want it to sound like we try to fight everything, but the cases I have worked on, the cases that I've come across with people, truly the person is still a danger to public safety.
Sure. And how, just out of curiosity, as a prosecutor, how often, I guess, did you see that, you know, someone come up for parole who completely faked their way out of the system or through the system to get out?
Oh, I think that's probably more often than not.
But does it work?
There's a term in the system called malingerers.
Oh.
Yes, it does work. There's a term in the system called malingerers, and they're very good. The other thing with the parole process that I think is very detrimental to society, to public safety, is they are given a psychological evaluation, and generally everyone I've seen always says this person is a low risk coming back. But the problem with that, and I'm not jamming on the evaluators, for lack of a better word, I can think of a word, they are only given a limited time, and they're not given the case file. So they take the version of the facts from the inmate. And that's the person that has the most bias, obviously. The victims are not interviewed in it. They basically take the inmate's version, they look at the rehabilitation, and they write a report.
Mm-hmm.
They spend maybe 2 to 3 hours with the person at the most. So it's a very skewed report. And it's unfortunate because they are relied on heavily in our system as the psychological evaluations. And I've always said, well, at least they should at least reach out to the victim because there may be a whole version. And the one I can give you is that in my own case, I believe it's 13 or 14 different versions to how my sister was murdered that have been given. And each and every time he's been considered, except for one psychological evaluation where he was bold moderate, he was always bold low risk to reoffend. And I'm like, hey, wait, he can't even tell you the truth. You know, how do you say if somebody's rehabilitated if they can't even begin to say the truth?
And so if someone, I mean, violently kills someone, how do they, I mean, what kind of a story do they tell that makes them sound like they're low risk?
Well, the first 2 or 3 times I believe he said that my sister had the gun, there was a struggle and it accidentally went off. Only the problem was that she was executed. So it's kind of hard to do that.
Yeah, kind
of. Then the version was that he was in a fit of rage and because she was breaking up with him. Well, again, my point to the parole board is that's fine, but he stole the gun prior. He threatened her prior. He followed her to her college campus. He had the presence of mind after he shot her and left her to die in the street. She died slowly and bled to death. He went up to his dorm room and watched Monday Night Football like nothing was wrong. That's not somebody that was in a fit of rage.
No. And does it hold any weight that he basically lied the first couple of times through the process? I mean, do they look at that?
They have brought that up in the last decision. They brought up some of the facts that I already, and again, I have a distinct advantage. I was a prosecutor, so, you know, and I can argue some things that maybe other people wouldn't pick up on. That's why I always encourage victims, this is just a side note, to reach out and at least talk to an attorney. Before they go to a parole hearing, they have a right to have one with them. And if they can do it and can afford it, you know, and I do it just on a pretty very minimal level to as far as cost-wise so that I can help as many as I can because there are things that they as a victim may not think that are important. Like, you know, the fact that he goes and watches, in my case, watch Monday Night Football right afterwards shows that he has presence of mind. And the case that I just argued, where the husband killed the wife, where he spent hours cleaning up the crime scene. That's not indicative of somebody, as he says, who just murdered his best friend and was lost.
Yeah, right. He was lost with a lot of Clorox and some sponges.
Somebody who wants to get away with it and has no remorse.
He suddenly, in a fit of cleaning, was very sad. Yeah. Wow, that's
so I do encourage victims heavily, and the district attorneys do a great job, but they're overwhelmed, to at least consult with a private attorney, to talk to them, you know, and to be versed in their rights as well, because lots of times, and again, it's just the way our system works, you'll have people say, oh, you can't speak. Well, no, they have an absolute right to speak, and they have to be heard. And so sometimes victims are very intimidated by that. So by reaching out and talking at least to some people that know their rights very well, can verse them on it, it empowers them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Besides that, I'm sure it's insanely emotional, and you get in there, and if you're not... you know, if you're not actually being helped by a professional, you could very easily leave and go, oh, all the things you didn't say. I think we've all done the steering wheel speech, you know, on our way home. For one thing or another, job interviews and, you know, things as basic as that, you just lock up, you forget.
Exactly.
We need to take one more quick break. We'll come back and finish out the top of the hour here with Nina. So, okay, Nina, you've got like 2 minutes to think of anything that we need to know that we don't know yet.
Okay, great.
Since we've obviously exhausted our information a long time ago reading your bio. We're talking about Crime Victims United today on the day before Memorial Day. Stick with us. We'll be right back. Man, you're rejoining We the People Radio here in our last 5 or 8 minutes or whatever it is. So, Nina, what's something else that you've seen from your vantage point that really people don't consider when they think about victims of violent crime? Uh-oh. She's coming.
Hello?
On. There you are.
Sorry.
No problem. So what are some things that people really don't consider, you know, as these, because let's face it, the things like Prop 47 are being passed because.
I mean, sorry, my dog.
All hell's breaking loose at Nina's house.
We're actually having a party for 100 people tonight, so there's people in and out of my house.
Release the hounds.
I apologize.
Classic.
Yeah. I think,
it's a Pomeranian.
Like in the, when we were just chatting, I think if I can encourage victims, public safety, I think knowledge is power. They're certainly welcome to call. I'm always available to answer questions at the office. But I also think if people just want to be informed, we do these updates. I try to do them weekly, once a month, and we try to put out something more comprehensive. And I just, my biggest thing as a prosecutor, as a victim advocate, is encouraging those that have been harmed to at least know their rights. And if they choose to enact them, I think it's an empowering thing. I mean, I worked with a lot of the rape victims that they were initially scared to testify, but once they did, it was very empowering. You know, one of the things with rape is a crime of power. And when you can take that power back, I think it's the greatest service you can give a victim.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And for those people who think that, you know, with all this victim, you know, what is it, nonviolent and victimless crime and all that, before they pass some other dopey measure like Prop 47 or something like that, what would you, if you had a chance to, you know, sit all the voters down and give them a talking to, what would you tell them?
I just think, don't be fooled by dollar titles.
That's true.
We're very creative in the way we write ballot titles. When I say we, people that work in the political system can be extremely creative. Don't be fooled by ballot titles. Read between the lines. Ask questions. You know, a lot of them get promoted as Justice and Safety Act or the Public Safety Act of such and such a year. and the net effect is they may be more harmful. It's kind of like when you're a young voter and you don't understand that a bond is a tax or things like that. I think being educated is important. I think when you're looking at who you want to elect, I mean, regardless of what party you are, I think you should elect what's best for your community. I actually, whether you like Donald Trump or not, that's people's individual choices. I like the fact that our system is being shaken up by somebody who's not a career politician. I just think it's an interesting trend for once. I think those kind of things are becoming important. I think people are getting a little bit tired of the norm, and hopefully that leads to more education of the general public.
Yeah, because some of this, when you realize what it's going to do, but I think what does happen is people go into the voting booth or they get their mail-in ballot and they do look at the title. And a lot of times Correct. It's the reform of blah, 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 blah. But really what it means is you're going to have more criminals in your neighborhood now.
Correct. I just think education is, you know, is powerful. And you may decide differently than I may decide, and that's our absolute right. But at least make your decision informed. You know, one of my closest friends is actually a defense attorney, and philosophically, we differ on mostly everything, but we can at least have an intelligent conversation and agree to disagree. And I think that is important when it comes to any of these kind of things.
Sure. Now, when it comes to ballot measures and things like that, I'm assuming that if there's something that involves victims' rights and that sort of thing, you guys probably have that on crimevictimsunited.com.
We do. We have both ways. If something is, you know, not, we think, anti-public safety, yes, we do. And actually, my mom, and again, great credit to her. She's the strongest woman I've ever come across. Lots of times she's asked to sign on a lot of public safety measures on the ballot. So I also tell people to look at who are the supporters.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
Who's signing it, who's signing against it, because that can tell you a lot.
Yeah, because hopefully they've done their homework and they know what it's really about.
Correct. And, you know, that can tell you a lot about the measure. I mean, it was actually very interesting in 2008 when we did Marcy's Law, which amended the Constitution, because we were outfunded by like 7-1, I believe, trying to defeat this constitutional amendment. And I give great credit to the people of the state of California, because I think people really read about it and saw who was supporting it, and it passed overwhelmingly. You know, it takes 2/3 to amend the Constitution, and we were over the top, and we were completely outspent. And unfortunately, in our system, money can make a difference in the political system, obviously, in advertising and things like that. But for whatever reason, in that case, it became landmark that we won with so little funding and just a huge grassroots effort.
Gosh, that's awesome. And I'm assuming you work a lot with the sheriff's organizations and all the different
yes.
law enforcement agencies around the state.
Yes, and most people are connected with our website, and we all try to communicate. You know, again, it's trying to do the best we can, realizing it's never going to be perfect and there's a balance. I just think it's trying to do the best we can.
Yeah, and getting the information out there. It's really easy to sign up for the updates on your site. Just go to the bottom of crimevictimsunited.com. Look at the bottom of the page. It says sign up for email updates. Bill signed up
Correct.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Well, yeah. I hope I get to talk with you guys again. This has been great.
Well, thanks
we
a million.
We appreciate you coming on. It's
Lisa,
very informative. We got some great responses out of our chat room. You really got folks fired up.
Oh, great. Well, again, and anybody's welcome to call if I can answer questions, and I hope to talk with you guys again, and have a great Memorial Day weekend.
You too. Thanks a lot, Nina. And okay. Lisa and Doug both said hi.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.